Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
I have no introduction for this, Josh Brown. I stayed up until 2 a.m. getting through Final Fantasy VII Rebirth. Haven't finished it yet. How are you feeling?
That's two 2 a.m. nights in a row for you. Why? You are going to be a dad in a month.
You're not wrong. I tell you what, so I need to make the most of it right now. Although, in theory, the child would keep me up until 2, 3 in the morning. So maybe it's training.
Great point. If you can train your brain right now to just kind of stay up for most of the night when the child needs you, you'll just be gaming anyway.
Yeah.
So you can just pop in the next room. But, unfortunately, what if you're in a game you can't pause? What if you play it online?
Oh, maybe there are certain things more important than the online game, unless it's Helldivers 2, in which case that child can wait.
Did you see that mad Bradley Cooper quote going around on Twitter? Where he was getting... I've been fascinated with Bradley Cooper, not to immediately derail this thing.
I love his new movie where he's an old man.
He just keeps saying weird stuff.
Right.
He keeps saying really strange things on
Bradley
this
Crowter.
Tour for Maestro. And the other day he was like, my kid, you know, when it was first born, I don't think I loved it for a long time. And he was like, if someone came in with a gun, I don't think I'd die for it. I was like, Bradley, you don't have to say everything that comes into your brain.
Don't.
I kind of respected the madness of it, though.
I didn't see that. I need to see the full context for that. Not that there's that many other ways you can give that full context, but I did see that quote. It's, pray tell I'm not Bradley Cooper if such a scenario happens. But I tell you, this is the UBP, the Untitled Banter podcast, of which an intro I have done in reverse, but it doesn't matter because that's Josh Brown.
Hello, Scott Telford.
Hello, where we get through as many questions, talking points, etc. that people have submitted. I did want to say, though, in regards to sleep, before I get to everyone's lovely questions, I find that I sleep better. This is maybe such a stupid thing to say.
Go on.
I sleep better and I enjoy sleep more when I've stayed up later the previous night. Like, I like a good long sleep as much as the next person, but I used to stay up until 1, 2, 3 in the morning every night and then get about 6 hours on average, 5 hours on average, and I would be out like a light, but I would sleep all the way through. Wasn't tossing and turning. I'd get up, it would be a living hell, but I'd get on with my day and I'd stay up until about 3 a.m. again. Now, you can argue that's not very healthy, but I think I was happier. And I've been doing it again with Helldivers and Final Fantasy and Infinite Wealth in a row. And I'm kind of loving it. I was so out like a light this morning, and my vision's a bit blurry right now, but I had a lovely time. And I'm just thinking, like, is this what sleep's supposed to be? You're supposed to be like out like a light, but as opposed to you go to bed at a reasonable time and I just toss and turn. It's 4 a.m., it's 5 a.m., I'm tossing and turning. I could have been gaming.
No, that is interesting because I think a lot of people have, you know, obviously different sleep patterns, but some people can oversleep very easily. My partner, she always oversleeps if she, like, even just goes to sleep until like 9 o'clock in the morning or something. She'll wake up and she's like, that's my day ruined. I've overslept. And I'm like, that's interesting because I can sleep until 2 p.m. and not oversleep. You know what I mean? I will say though, when I was off for 4 months, right, you would think that because I wasn't doing anything, I would have the best, most relaxing sleep ever. Those were some of the worst sleeps because I wasn't doing anything during the day.
You hadn't tidied yourself out.
And I hadn't tidied myself out and it took me ages to get to sleep. Usually I hit the pillow and I'm gone in 5 minutes.
Right.
And for whatever reason, across those 4 months, it was like an hour.
You hit the
an
floor.
An hour and a half.
I was building my Valentine once.
Certainly did. The tears did fall and they crashed around me. Only tune I know. But the point is, it was a strange realization of, maybe I need work to knacker me out so I can do that magic trick of falling asleep in 30 seconds.
I always thought, right, this is the weirdest thing. When you're, and I don't mean to ruin everyone's day or night as they're listening to this, but I always find that it's weird when you're aware of going to sleep. Like, oh, yeah. It's almost like welcoming death. Like, you're just like, I always think, because you're lying there going like, well, at some point I'm going to shut off. Like, yeah. It's going to end. You're just going to wake up in the morning again. Like, I think it's weird voluntarily shutting off your consciousness. Like, and I if you're tired enough, you won't really think about it. Yeah. But sometimes, like, it's more during the pandemic where everything collapsed in regards to mental processes anyway.
Yes.
But there was just that thing of like lying on a pillow late at night going like, well, I should be asleep. Am I asleep yet? No, I'm not asleep yet. Am I tired enough? I don't know. And then just being aware of it and being like, okay, can I make this happen? Like, I wish we had a manual sleep switch.
Yeah.
I wish we could just click a button and go to sleep. That'd be way easier.
Yeah, like an open world or survival game where it's like, I'm going to wait for 6 hours.
A little melody plays in the background, yeah.
That's interesting. I wonder if that's linked to your thing of not liking doing nothing as well, like lying on the couch and doing nothing, which is my favorite thing
to do. Well, yeah, I would never do nothing at all.
There we go.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have a whole thing about passive entertainment where if I'm watching a movie, I'll be itching for a game or something with my hands, guitar, whatever, unless it's a really, really, really good movie or TV show. Anyway.
No, yes. I want to add one more thing to this.
Yes.
And I've already forgotten it, so this segue is completely pointless. I've never thought that, and I'm really interested to see if other people do, like the turning your consciousness off thing, because I always think of dreaming as like my consciousness continues. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why, but ever since, I've always like dreamt, but like since I've been on this medication especially, like the dreams were vivid.
Right.
So I was like looking forward to sleeping to see what dreams were going to come up, because some of them were scary.
I used to love that. Yeah, when I was younger, I used to love dreaming. I used to love the idea of, I still kind of like the idea of lucid dreaming. It's like before VR was true.
Yeah.
Like it feels like lucid dreaming was the nearest you could get to a lifelike video game that you can control. And I was like, well, I can't fly in real life. Maybe if I, and when I was a kid, I was like, if I dream about it hard enough, I'll dream that I'm Superman and I can fly around. Never happened. No. Never give me that. It was always like, oh, you're in a playground and here's the bullies again. It was never what you want.
My brain started to trick myself because it knows I can sort of see the Matrix. Over the past year or something, I've always been able to, well, not always, but kind of been able to recognize when I'm in a dream. So if something bad happens and it feels real, in the narrative of my head, I go, oh, don't worry, it's just a dream. And I had one of those dreams the other night where everything was going wrong, and I had the epiphany of, oh, not to worry, it's a dream. And then I woke up, but I woke up inside another dream, and then I was like, oh, no, it was real. No.
Josh-ception.
It tricked me, and then I woke up for real. So it was a dream inside a dream, and I was like, you bastard.
That's
brain.
Nightmarish, yeah.
How have you done that to me? How have you gotten past my firewall? What
Chris
are you
Nolan.
Up to?
Chris Nolan's sitting to the side with a mind control device. But yeah, we'll get through as many questions as we can. One from Mouse Hands, who says, no question this week. Just want to send some love and support to Josh for going through therapy and taking a flight. Shout out to everyone who takes mental health seriously. Everyone deserves to be happy, healthy, and have their voices heard. Let's make 2024 a great year. I just wanted to echo that as loudly as possible. Man's about to do his little flight on Sunday.
That's a lovely surprise. Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm crapping bricks, Scott.
You get free peanuts, mate.
Every day I go to my partner, I'm like, I'm on a flight this weekend, you know? And she's like, I'm sick of hearing about it. Like, shut up. I don't care.
I'm flying away from you.
No, it should be okay. The fact that it's, I've not completely broken down is an improvement. I can't say I'm 100% well, but it is an interesting marker to look at where I was last year and now where I am now. And I think that's always important to put things in perspective, because you might never get 100% there, but you're always hopefully moving, whether it's up or down.
Yeah, I think as well, which is good for a plane you want to go up. I think you should do the thing that you talk about where you channel things through art and expression and creativity and have maybe some sort of journal, maybe some sort of note-taking exercise, maybe something like that that'll ground your thoughts in a way that would get you through that process of at least getting up in the air.
Well,
and then you can enjoy the view.
It's funny you should say that. I actually, had my first therapy session this week and got some some homework, as she described it, to do that is very similar. So I might take them along and at the very least, even if it doesn't help me, I'll chart those thought processes, be able to take them back to her next week. Mm-hmm. Made an immediate mistake, by the way. I don't want to tell the taxi driver story, actually, when I accidentally phoned Jules Gill and he thought I was getting killed because the taxi driver was swearing.
Maybe we should wait that him. Jules can do his side of that story when he returns to the UBP, because I have not even talked to Jules about this yet. But some sort of, what do the Americans even call it butt dialing.
Butt dialing.
When you butt dial someone, but you did it, and then there was too much noise, and Jules thought you were being killed.
That's fun. It was just a lovely conversation with a taxi driver, but it was like a sweary, jawdy taxi driver, and Jules is like, "You all right, man? I just heard someone swear, and he sounded like he was having a go at you." And I was like, "No, I was in therapy while this happened." Anyway, what was the point of the story? Can't remember. The point is, I hope Ireland's good.
Yes,
therapy, working on stuff.
You said you'd made a mistake so far, but I don't know what that was. You said you did something right. It wasn't not buying tech in it. We know about that one.
It wasn't not buying tech in it. I can't remember what the mistake was, Scott Tilford.
That's fair enough.
It doesn't really matter. Maybe I'll have to work on that as well.
Maybe it'll be saved up by your subconsciousness. Question from HP Buncraft, who says, "Hello, Scott and Josh. I created an X account so I could ask the UBP this. I never go back to single player games after finishing them. Do you have any single player games that you feel are worth playing or still worth playing after completing them? Not replay, but continuing to explore the world." That's a very key distinction.
That
here.
Is a key distinction, because I was going to say something completely different without that.
Same. The ones where I want to go back and just live in the world more.
Yeah.
I'm going to go with Ghost of Tsushima, mainly because of how I played that game. And I was doing some of the question mark stuff, doing some of the random points on the map, but I loved the whole idea of just being the Ghost of Tsushima by the end of that game and just looking after everyone, like dipping in, sort of making sure all the civilians are okay, being the Batman of that island kind of thing. Most of the time, I find that most games give you that last save thing.
Yeah.
God of War was a really good one. God of War Ragnarok, where I just liked mopping stuff up. I have one at the minute, which is tied to a thing. It's in Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth. But I'm kind of going to wait. I'm going to wait a little bit until people have played a bit more of that game. They put something in the trailers for that game that gave away a major plot beat in regards to Kazuma Kiryu and what's happening with him. So it's technically not a spoiler, whatever. I would still be annoyed if I knew it beforehand.
Right.
But one of my favorite ones of these is in that game, but it fundamentally relies on a spoiler, so I'm going to give it a few weeks. And at some point, me and you will talk about it. Maybe it's on the Winder, maybe it's on another UBP, or whatever. That game's phenomenal, but there's something in there that reminds me of that. Do you have any game worlds you want to live in?
You know what? I used to have loads. And actually, first off, thank you for making an X account and joining that hellscape to ask us the question. It's a very nice reason to do it. It is, isn't it?
Make sure you disconnect every day.
Very much appreciated.
Yeah, just don't do anything else.
Thank you very much. Hopefully these answers will satisfy us. we'll make it all worthwhile. Anyway,
yes.
I used to do it all the time, but I don't do it much at all anymore. Like when I was younger, I remember like just jumping into Crackdown, especially to just, you know, mess around in that world for a little bit, blow up a load of cars, see how much anarchy I could cause.
Right.
Grand Theft Auto, of course, just living in those worlds and going in for a hit. I still do that sometimes now, where I'll jump in GTA 5 or jump into GTA Online to see how my custom character's up. What's he up to in his apartment? I don't know. Drive around the streets.
He's changing his clothes by himself again.
He certainly has. He's singing in the shower, which is very, you know, realistic, actually. But these days, now the way I play games is I like to mop up all of that side stuff before I finish the main campaign.
Oh, okay.
So it's actually very rare that I go back to a game just to exist in the world. Honestly, the only one I've done it with recently is Spider-Man, because the swinging is so good, and sometimes I just like a hit of that. But otherwise, I like to kind of almost complete the game before I complete the game these days.
I'm way too spoiler phobic. Like, I'm definitely got that at the minute with Final Fantasy Rebirth, where I'm like, I need to get to the end because I need to see what this big story scene is, and I need to know what you guys have done. So we've talked loads about like how much you divert time between main stuff and side stuff, and I can't do too much side stuff because I'm too aware that I'm not progressing the main story, and maybe I'll see a spoiler somewhere.
That makes sense, though.
Which is like, in this case, it's the thing that's being talked about.
I think the difference is now that it's not like games are cheaper. In fact, they're more expensive now, obviously, but there's so much access to games and there's such a variety of game pricing that there's always something for me to play. Obviously, I have more money now than I did when I was 15, 16, when I had no money, but even just the introduction of like a Game Pass or a PlayStation Plus means that if I have those subscriptions, there are literally thousands of games vying for my attention. You know, we talked about this yesterday. The media bandwidth that you have now is so bottlenecked, I find.
Yeah,
so I find it harder to justify going back to a game for just to mess around when I know there's probably something else that I kind of want to get to. And just personally, my drive to stay in a game world now just weirdly finishes once the main story's complete. It feels wrapped up. There are a few exceptions, like a Bethesda RPG, for instance, that I will go back. It's kind of impossible to do everything in those games before you finish it off. But a Ghost of Tsushima, you know, we've said before, I pretty much finished everything and then did the final mission.
Yeah, I like a main thread. It depends how it's done. Like, I like the idea of the final main mission being the bow on that entire experience, and you're watching the credits going like, that was Thanos style, that was good. Like, yeah. I'm breathing that in. But also, like, certain stories are told in a way where you do the main stuff, and that reinforces why you then live in that world. And I remember in Ragnarok's case, like I mentioned before, like, the state the Kratos ends up in, it makes sense that you would then go out and do as much as you could kind of thing. But it's also weird because as a player, you have to choose when you're done. And yeah. It's like, there's no, like, final state, then you're just mopping stuff up, being like, well, I think the realm's in a good place. I'm going to step back and just kind of leave it, which in a way metatextually works for where his brain is at.
Yes.
But still,
I think this question is really interesting as well in the context of live service games, which rely on people coming back for another hit, just to explore a little bit more, to grind a little bit more, to kind of check in and do your dailies. That kind of loop has never resonated with me, which is probably why I'm a little bit harsher on live service games, because once I've kind of finished the bulk of the main content or like the main side missions, why would I go back to Suicide Squad? For me personally, just to grind out some more missions to replay, grind out some more weapons to replay missions I've already done. It's kind of why I fell off. I love my time with the original Division, but immediately fell off once I finished credits and didn't do the Dark Zone or anything.
I did want to mention, because this is a question that we got, which is perfect for this, from Dahi, who said, considering the success of Helldivers 2, what idea would you come up with for a community-driven, emergent, real-time storyline?
Oh.
Which is the thing is, like, I think that's the secret sauce to me, because one of the reasons Helldivers 2 is doing so well is that feeling of, like, you're just one decimal point percentage contributing to this overall storyline, and you see bits of it on screen. It's like, this planet is being taken over because you and millions of other people all fought the automatons at once, or the bugs at once, or whatever. And during the week, you had Arrowhead reveal that they do have a dungeon master, they have a DM, a member of staff, I think he's called Joel or Jack or something, who is literally in charge of reinforcing the planets or changing some of the storylines or unleashing certain set pieces on the global audience. And I was like, that's effing awesome.
Yeah, man.
Why was that not a standard thing for so many live services? Because the live service storytelling side of it, we haven't really had the two married yet. And I always thought it was weird when you're in a multiplayer game and they make you all watch the same cutscene.
Yeah.
Because I'm just like, it's just a weird thing having like a storytelling device in a multiplayer thing. But doing it through gameplay is great. And like right now, the Helldivers community or the Helldivers players know about what it felt like to lose a planet like last week. Like,
yes.
Malevolon Creek or whatever it's called. And we all fought in that battle, quote unquote, we all lost in that battle, and we have like a story, there's a weird like narrative reason there.
Yeah.
And it's just great. And it's like knowing that they're in control of that, and they have all these set pieces lined up, they have all these things ready to go based on how people perform, how the story goes in a wider narrative sense. I absolutely love that stuff.
Me too, man. I mean, I don't play Fortnite, but I have no idea why more companies haven't ripped off its approach to live service, because I don't play the game, but I'm still excited every single time there's a new season with a new event. Like, I wish I was there to battle Galactus. You know, I'm watching some of my friends do that and have that experience. Or I wish I was there when the map completely changed or blew up or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those big events that have actual consequence, I think, are just incredible at bringing a community together and giving you a reason above just the regular grind to keep returning to these live service games. You know, we talked for months and months before the Avengers dropped in 2020 about how that kind of superhero sandbox would have been perfect for those moments. Have, you know, a villain drop into a part of the open world and, you know, introduce a story with him with an original narrative and, you know, more interactions and maybe even a few levels and more gadgets and weapons and stuff. And it's a reason to jump back in because it's kind of consequential. You know, I think Call of Duty Warzone could do way more with this idea as well. It's had a few interesting ideas in the past, like when Verdansk, the original Warzone map, got nuked.
Right.
That was a really cool event. That was, you know, exciting to experience in the moment because it is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity, because that's not going to happen again.
Mm.
That map has been nuked. It went away. The map might come back, but that event won't. And I think, you know, that element of eventizing the live service narrative, I don't know why that's not more of a thing, because at least to me, that's the most exciting part of what a live service can offer that a regular game can't.
Totally. I think that whole idea of, like, in the Avengers case, I'm sure it was talked about at some point before the Avengers came out, that idea of, hey, such and such is loose in the city, you better respond now kind of thing, and it's like a reason to dive on. It's a bit Pokemon Go-y of like, oh, this you know, rare creature is like over the road and you should go to this other city and see if you can retrieve it or whatever. there's cool things there that you can do in a live space. For me, that idea of coming up with what would you do for a completely like unique new real-time storyline, for me, it's all about like alien invasion stuff. I love it. I would, in Helldivers, have Predator drop into that, one of those planets. Don't tell the community what it is. You have him drop in. It would have to be one of the nighttime missions, one of the automaton missions. You wipe out the squads. The way that game's AI works is you have different patrols of enemies around the open world anyway, but then you see something in the trees. You see something that is optic camo. You hear it, and you go, is that the Predator click noise?
Yeah.
Are we being hunted right now? And you have players all tell each other, because one of the coolest things in gaming history is when Elite Dangerous, who did the alien invasion, and only one player got invaded, and right. Their ship, it was a first-person game, they're in their ship, they're flying around, it's a space game like No Man's Sky, and their ship suddenly went off out of power, which isn't the thing that happens in that game as far as I know.
Yeah.
All the lights went off, they didn't know what was going on, and this giant alien ship just came over the top of them, like the start of Star Wars.
Oh, that's so sick.
Unbelievable. And they had to just go online and be like, what the hell is this? What's going on? And they were the only person who saw it. As far as that got reported, I didn't play Elite Dangerous myself, but the point is the same. Like, you can do so many cool things like that, and things spread like wildfire online. Like, you know, look at the Willy Wonka thing right now.
Yeah.
And it's like, if one person experiences something, they can capture it, they can put it online. For me, it's all about sort of the surprise, yeah, and the buzz, and the, oh my God, is that in my game? Like, I bet I should have a look and whatever. And then contributing to that overall sort of completion state of like, well, I'm going to go and hunt the Predator. He's somewhere on this planet. Let's get the boys together and see if we can go hunt this thing.
No, I love that, man. I love that idea. I think anything like that, that retains an element of mystery and surprise. I think surprise of any kind is so rare in the video game space these days. Usually when you get a game, you kind of know exactly what it's going to be, even if you haven't played it. Mm-hmm. You know, there might be some narrative twists, of course, but you kind of know what is possible and what isn't.
Someone's data mined the files and ruined it again.
Literally, yeah. All of that information's already out. So to have a live service, I think, allows you to sneakily implement stuff like that in a really interesting way that kind of rallies the community. Again, I don't play much Call of Duty Zombies and was never really into that community, but I loved what those games did with Easter eggs, you know, requiring the community to work together to solve this larger mystery and figure out all of the different puzzles and investigate the clues and stuff. Anything that kind of rallies people in a more meta way than just, oh, we can go back and grind some more loot, I think is, you know, really fulfilling the potential of what games as an art form and medium can be.
Yeah, man, it's like reintroducing elements of narrative and storytelling and creativity to something that is quite a boring online framework. Like, here's your dailies, here's your weeklies, go grind them out. Aren't you having fun yet? Like, it's such a boring corporate way of approaching a set of systems that could be so much more fun. Question from Tarnished Yaz, who says, you awesome dudes, with physical media slowly dying, what has been your oddest game purchase? Mine has to be Metal Gear Solid 4, which I bought on sale, but I hadn't bought the PS3 yet. I used it as an incentive to do overtime to buy the console. Hope you both have a Final Fantasy style week. I've put this in here because you collect way more old school stuff than I do. Like, I have my old school game collection, but it's rare that I have, like, that's all emulation, whereas you have your PS2 still hooked up and everything.
Yeah, I buy a load of old crap all the time, man. It, like, much to the chagrin of the space that's left in my flat. I've got a load of old crap, Scott. I've got a load of old odd games that I think would be perfect for this. I've got G.I. Jockey on the PlayStation 2.
Is that a G1 Jockey?
G1 G.I. Jockey, imagine that. Oh, I've just got a great $1 million pitch there.
Why does that not exist?
G.I. Jockey.
Horses with guns, Josh.
Listen, he's a jockey, but he's also a G.I.
But that writes itself. Well, that's the most perfect
thing. That's why it's an odd purchase, because I don't like horse racing. It was when I was little, because my dad bet on it, but it's not for me, so I've just got that in the house.
Why have you got it? How'd you get that?
I don't know, man. I've got that. I've got Pop Idol. I just like...
Why?
I don't know, because I think it would be funny. I think, wouldn't it be funny to play these games and then never get them? Some I get gifted. I got Pop Idol.
It is funny. You could have just said you owned that and I would have laughed anyway.
You should have. I know, I could have just lied, couldn't I? Seen this firsthand of me going into a shop, seeing something and just thinking, I need that now.
Yeah.
Like when I bought Fear Effect on PlayStation 1, not even knowing what that is.
You were like the Manchurian candidate. You sort of like sprung up and faced it and pointed at it and I'm getting that.
Yeah, it's like I've been activated by something. I'm like, oh, I must buy it.
The brain chip.
I think it's because I am a big believer of do judge a book by its cover. Not with people, but in terms of media, like that's the way I buy books. That's the way I buy games. I mean, how many games have I just bought by looking at the cover for them on the recently announced,
every single one.
Recently released PlayStation Store or whatever. So I do that a lot. So yeah, I think G1 Jockey, pop idol, and I'm currently eyeing up not Resident Evil, Silent Hill Downpour.
Yes.
And the only reason I haven't bought that yet is because it's 45 quid secondhand.
Ridiculous. Get Tekken 8 for the love of God.
Nah, man. Oh. What about Silent Hill Downpour?
What about Silent Hill Downpour?
You know what's really annoying?
Yes, this. Carry on.
When I got the PlayStation 1 back last yes. year, the games that I went out to buy were Star Wars The Phantom Menace and Tomb Raider 3, and then I got Fear Effect.
Yes.
And what happened, Scott Tailford? A year later, The Phantom Menace and Tomb Raider 1, 2, and 3 were added to the PlayStation 5 anyway, so I'm like, cool, thanks.
Such is the curse of the retro collector. Yes. I can throw in, because I've got my N64 that I got for my 30th, and I love getting random 90s games that, like, just for the sake of going back to that time period. So I got Rogue Squadron, the Star Wars game that was on N64. I got FIFA 98, because oh, I was wow. like, that'd be funny to go back to an old school football game. And I got another one, which I'm forgetting the name of, but I get them if they're like £5, £2, £3 in a CEX, a pre-owned place, yeah. just for an afternoon. Just for a little dabble, alongside the majority of my old school stuff being on Steam Deck or my phone or whatever. Like I like a good emulated library. Yeah. I love the way Nintendo do it, because it's just, here's a launcher with like a ton of a whole platform there. But N64 stuff, I'll mine the ridiculous like archives of stuff that was released in the 90s.
It's nice having a collection, I think.
Yeah.
Older games especially, and just being able to go back to them, because I think, you know, there are so many odd games that release now, but most of them kind of come out on Steam,
yeah,
add on game yeah. on PC, so I miss a lot of those weird indie titles that release, so mm-hmm. I have to go back to like the PS2 era to get those strange games that you just can't believe exist, like The Sopranos Road to Respect, which was absolutely
it was certainly something.
It provided me with an excellent day off. I remember playing through that entire thing, you know, games like that where you just think, what is this?
Yeah.
Like, why did this come out? And it, I like investigating them.
I remember, shout out to Mike Bithell and the Play Watch Listen podcast, but he said that 9 times out of 10 when those things existed, they're just promotional materials. They had some money left over in the budget to greenlight something on a game level, and the average game budget price was so much lower back then that you might as well do a game tie-in.
Yeah.
Which is why all those games were so crunched to death when they were being made. They're so terribly polished. The game movie tie-in had such a bad name for so long, unless it was Toy Story 2, because they just didn't have the polish whatsoever or the time to bring it together.
Have you ever done what this question suggests mm-hmm. in buying a game when you either don't have a console or maybe you don't have the time to play it yet, but just so you kind of have it, so it's there when you can eventually get it?
I only ever did that with Skyrim in 2011, because I was doing my dissertation. Right. So I bought Skyrim, I left it in the cellophane wrapping, and I put it on the end of my table so I'd have to look at it. And I was like, I will have to get through. I made a marker of like 5,000, 6,000 words, and then I'll play it. And I broke that rule. I only got a few thousand words in, where it was like lunchtime, and I was like, I can play a little bit of it. I can do the intro, it's fine. And everything all worked out or whatever. But I only have done that once, and it was like a weird double-edged sword thing where I was like trying to brain F myself into thinking I could force work and then that'd be the reward. It was a whole thing. Question from the luckiest gunner, who says, is authorship a hindrance for games as a whole? I have immense respect for creatives like Sakurai and Kojima, but at some point it feels like we get announcements for 10 plus Kojima projects that won't come out for half a decade just so they can have his name attached.
I love this question, and
same.
I think it actually links with the discussion that should be up on the channel, the YouTube channel, by the
Maybe.
Time this goes live, about just the state of AAA games now. Mm-hmm. I can totally see the perspective of it being frustrating to see someone like Kojima announce all of these projects and know that they're not going to come for years and years and years. I guess I think I value authorship in this medium in particular, because I would maybe argue that those games, even though we have to wait for them, probably wouldn't be greenlit if they were from someone else. You know, I think there are so few authors in the industry, kind of because the industry, well, one, it's so collaborative, but two, I think executives want studios to be known as studios rather than individuals. But that does mean that when an author comes along, like a Hideo Kojima, there's a lot of clout and there's a lot of power that comes with that position to, I think, green light games that otherwise wouldn't see the light of day. Like, I don't think a Microsoft or a Sony without the Kojima name would have made something like Death Stranding the way
it
was.
No, not at all.
Its edges would have been sanded down. It would have been way more mainstream. Probably would have had way more combat in it. It wouldn't have been the same game, you know? So I I value authorship in that way. I do mm-hmm. think there's a reality where it goes too far and someone gets too much credit, you know, when games are just so collaborative. But I think they are important because they're the people, I think, who can fight back, for lack of a better term, yeah. against the money men and the businessmen who want to only make certain games that will hit X amount of profits.
Yeah, man, that's perfectly put. Like, the more that fight back is a really key part of it. The whole idea that, was it either Jason West or Vince Zampella, the Respawn guy?
Yes, but yeah.
Which either of those dudes who, like, they formed Respawn, but one of them, like, stuck around and sort of seemed to help shape the Jedi Fallen Order and Jedi Survivor games.
Yeah, I think that's Vince Zampella.
Zampella, yeah. And but that idea of having the creative vision that is bulletproof, is ironclad, can be the thing that you, like you said, fight back against the corporates with. Look at the making of Anthem and how, like, the key creatives left during that game's production. And if you don't have those people at the top, let's say, or the people at the forefront, the tip of the spear, to be able to say, no, we can't put X monetization option in here, we can't drag such and such thing out because we're aiming for this, then that's an important thing. I always think it's fascinating, the idea of the individual creator or the individual authority, because, like, this is going to be such a weird comparison, but, like, governments and parliaments and, like, leadership in general, it always goes down to one person, like a Biden or a Rishi Sunak. I couldn't even think of who we had as our dude for. But the idea...
too many,
I know. The idea that one person can do everything. Right. I think there's a human toll to that, depending on the scale of the job, where, all of a sudden they actually can't get to everything. There's so many emails you can answer in a day, so many conversations you can have in a day. And I think that at some point, for certain scales of production, certain scales of jobs and outputs and turnarounds, you probably need a team who are all as well equipped as each other, which is interesting to bring it back to gaming with, like, Final Fantasy VII Rebirth, where it's the same core people who did the original Final Fantasy VII and then Remake, where they've been getting out there saying that the majority of the staff were kept on for Rebirth. They wanted to keep going. And you can feel that. Rebirth feels like a direct continuation of a Remake in the vast majority. But yeah, that whole idea of, like, authorship, like, that used to be, it's a double-edged sword where, like you said, it ends up coming across like a team on Celebrated as much as the person. Yes. And so many coders, writers, everything else, art departments don't get the recognition because it's a Hideo Kojima game. Kojima made all that.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah,
nah,
yeah.
He did, like, he Kojima is actually a bit more of a special case because he does get stuck in. He actually edits the trailers. He does, like, dip into each art department and things. But most people, it's a team effort.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I definitely don't want to underplay that.
No.
You know, even if you do have someone, directing the entire project, you've got sub-directors, you've got executive producers, you've got all these people who have their, like, major input on games, and that, I think, is something to be championed for sure. I just think with the way the industry, and not even just the gaming industry, but the media industry is made up right now, I still think for whatever reasons, executives do still, well, some of them, value the power that comes with an auteur.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This podcast is brought to you by Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it just makes hiring all in one place so easy, because you just get unparalleled access to job seekers. Plus, listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/WCG. Just go to Indeed.com/WCG right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/WCG. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You know, I mean, think of the movie space and the bidding war over Christopher Nolan's Oppenheimer when he moved away from WB. Like, Universal, I know it seems like an obvious thing now, but they spent way more than they should have in terms of what the market was telling them at the time for what Chris Nolan was going to give them, like a $100 million R-rated historical drama that's 3 hours long and partly in black and white. Like, that shouldn't have worked.
No.
It did, because, you know, Nolan's able to bring the clout that he has, the respect that he has, the audience he has, and kind of make something that would usually be a niche product in anyone else's hands a billion-dollar success and justify that. And I think that I like that we have those creatives that still have that power, and I don't want to see that go away completely in the gaming space, even though I do think we need to be mindful about, like, games as a product being a team effort.
Yeah, the team effort side of it and the human cost side of it. That's why I mentioned individual, like, it's not like Joe Biden isn't struggling, for example, someone like that.
Well, we talked in the WB podcast about James Gunn. In his power over WB and DC, you know, overseeing games, overseeing movies, overseeing TV shows. And it's like, the buck stops with him. I know he's got David Zaslav above him, but he's the creative lead. And that's a lot for one dude to take
on.
Well,
I mean, you've literally got Neil Druckmann and Corey Barlog of Naughty Dog and Sony Santa Monica fame, or Last of Us and God of War fame, saying they're pretty burnt out. Like, Neil Druckmann saying, I don't know how many more of these I've got in me at this point. That was also why, you know, Bruce Straley left Naughty Dog after doing Uncharted 2 straight into Last of Us, into Uncharted 4, and then just being like, I need to step away from this. Like, they're way too big a project. Like,
yeah, absolutely.
7-8 years for one thing.
That is what worries me, because they are huge projects. The toll is exceptional, not just on them, but obviously everyone in the bloody studio and everything that's going on right now. But yeah, I worry that this industry it doesn't support workers generally, but that's just going to drive those key creatives and those auteurs out of the industry. I look at Neil Druckmann and I see the games that he's made and I love them, but him saying, you know, the toll is too much, I've only got a few left in me, he's now got avenues to go into television if he wants to. He's got that caliber in terms of, you know, writing The Last of Us TV show, being a core executive producer on that, like, core showrunner. He's got that caliber now. Maybe he's looking at other industries and going, well, I can still be creatively fulfilled and the industry is more welcoming to creatives. It's fairer to creatives. It's not perfect by any means, of course it's not, but, like, compared to the toll that games take, it's probably his
because I'll shout out his interview with Logic. I didn't even know who Logic was, but some raps man, and he's got a podcast. Apparently he's a deal, and he's done a really good interview with Neil Druckmann. He's a really good interviewer, and Druckmann talked about the crux with this thing was a scale thing, and when he was asked that question, it was like, not too many at this level. So I think he might end up, he could do the classic thing of, like, you form another studio. Like, you know, that seems to be the response to all the AAA stuff at the minute, is you have lots of key creatives taking the money they have, the investment grants, whatever it is, and forming a smaller side studio. That's what some ex-BioWare devs have done. That's why we're getting Exodus, because it's what they couldn't do under EA.
I thought it was really interesting in the Naughty Dog Grounded 2 documentary, where they were also talking about, like, the mistakes they've made as a company, and one of them was promoting creatives to the position of manager. And they were saying, like, it makes sense for, you know, like, those people who were doing really well on a story front or a programming front to be promoted. But why is promotion people managing and not the creative side? So they were talking about how they introduced two different roles. Like, they've got people who will, you know, become managers and manage the floor and manage people's workflow and stuff. And the creatives can get promoted into other roles where they keep being creative. They've just got a bit more control. They've got a bit more power, probably got a bit more salary. And I think that's important, because not everyone, and I'm speaking for myself at this point. Not everyone's aspiration is to just climb the corporate ladder get more money and become a manager. Like, the fact that our society is kind of built around that template is weird to me, especially that carries over to creative industries. So
especially when so much money is in the creative vision, in actually bringing the thing to life.
And I think that's what's kind of pushing some people to go and create smaller studios where they kind of have that creativity back, because from experience, like, the further up the ladder you get, the more responsibilities you have from management and corporate. Mm-hmm. And like, does a creative want to spend all of their time, you know, talking about spreadsheets and talking about, like, keeping the budget?
No, they don't, Josh.
Under wraps.
And Scott
is giving me a very knowing look over there, himself recently having a promotion, and I don't mean to single you out or anything. Just talking about it generally. But I think that is, I mean, like I say, it's something I reckon with. I'm like, what am I going to do next? Because if I keep climbing the corporate ladder, eventually I'll probably have to be a manager, but I don't want to do that. So would it be better to, you know, just kind of stay where I am? And I'm personally fine with that.
But that's the thing. It's like, why can't more money get put into the creation roles? Like, it shouldn't have to be management based. Yeah, I did those reactions because, that's the life that I have, with a foot in both sides. I refuse to let go of the creative side, but I also took on all the management stuff. So I just do everything and burn myself out.
You certainly do.
As it is. However, that whole reality of a creative person going up the ladder and having to be more responsible for stuff is the thing that burned out Jeff Gerstmann over a Giant Bomb, or at least what he's talked about, why they were sort of so up for getting away from that machine after so long. Giant Bomb being one of the most important video game websites and outlets of all time. Like, but that's what happened to him. You also had the Double Fine documentary about how they made Psychonauts 2. And I forget the name of the exact program. I think it's Ralph someone, who was an artist, sorry. And they talk about, because that documentary is like a 20-part thing. They go into every facet of making a game. I can't recommend it enough. But there's one bit in that where the team got so big and they hired some more people that artist then had to be a manager. And he's literally saying, like, well, it kind of sucks because I don't get to draw and do stuff anymore.
Yeah.
But that's the way that it is. And it's like, now I just sit and I watch other people do the fun things.
Yeah,
and it's like,
right?
No, that sucks. That absolutely sucks.
Absolutely. I mean, just even outside of that kind of big structure, imagine having those arguments and those fights every day with executives who don't care about video games as an art, only care about shareholders and the bottom line, and you're their first point of contact because you're in charge of the game. Like, all you want to do is, you know, make a great piece of art and probably make some money alongside it, right?
Yeah.
But you can't do that because your entire bandwidth, again, been loving that word recently, is taken up by these meetings with the people at the very top who are saying, what if we don't have a female protagonist? What if we get all of these microtransactions in there? What do you think about an in-game store? Can we cut this off and sell it later? Every single day.
I'm fascinated by that in a game space, because you can see, like, not everyone's going to think the same way. Like, not everyone's going to be a creative. It's fine. Yep. There are places for everybody. It's just that whole idea of like numerically calculating fun, numerically calculating an aspect of being worthwhile. Those are fascinating conversations. And all those people are doing, in theory, unless they overstep, is looking at metrics, looking at things that are previously not done well, looking at things that might do well, and suggesting it, in theory, in a nice way. And then trying to bring those things together is, you know, the miracle of video games, or the miracle of being able to create something at a certain production level. But I do think that you feel those boundaries be overstepped. If it was a Venn diagram between the creative and the business, you feel the business circle encroach way more of the creative on certain projects, like Suicide Squad, or like the last few years of a lot of the upper echelon of gaming. Like, you can just see those corporate decisions. You can feel them when you play certain titles. And something like a Helldivers 2 is creative going back over on the business side. That game's microtransactions are fundamentally cosmetic. You can get some weapons, but they don't necessarily they don't really do anything other than just they look a bit better. So it's like, I think there's a good push and pull there. And I don't want to be negligent of the reality of people who do the business side, because it is important.
Yes.
But I just, I'm fundamentally creative. So like, it is a thing where it's a multifaceted reality.
No, you're absolutely right. I think with your Venn diagram comparison,
I love a Venn diagram.
Yeah, and when you're talking about,
I'm
that
forever in the middle of one.
In that air, sort of business side kind of encroaching. Like, obviously, they need to work in sync. You need people for distribution, for marketing, and all of that stuff to make sure a game you know, is on time. You need producers, all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I look at the executives who are in charge right now. And again, I have no evidence to prove this, but take Bobby Kotick, for instance. I don't believe, right, genuinely, that man has ever played a video game. Like, I just don't. I can't see it. Can you picture it, right?
Well, didn't he, I don't know enough about him, didn't he come in, though, on a really low, like, didn't he come in as, like, an intern or a coder or something at the very, very beginning?
If he did do that, I don't think he's played a video game since 1983. I don't think he's played any of like Activision's most recent output for more than 10 minutes. Even that, I think, is being generous. Mm. What I mean by that is like, if you have creatives that are, if you have executives that are interested in video game as an art form, I think that's obviously fine. I just don't think we have many of those right now.
No.
There are, of course, some that exist, but it's the same in movies where I look at something like David Zaslav and I think, like, do you care about films? Do you care about television?
No, they don't.
Like, no, you care about being a CEO.
Yes,
right?
Which was the Jim Ryan PlayStation era. Like, you can tell when, like, he did that recent interview, which Sacred Symbols' Colin Moriarty talked about. Like, they highlighted it when he's asked what his favorite games are, and he just cites, like, GTA 3, it was a big deal for the industry. And it's all these sort of, like, quite simple ways of referring to games as opposed to, oh, I love this mission, I love the way this thing played. There's a direct comparison in Sony's case between the way Sean Layden talks and cites Viv Ribbon versus Jim Ryan and saying the original Gran Turismo looks terrible.
Even, you know, Phil Spencer, like, he's on my crap list at this moment in time for the way Xbox has been running all of the layoffs over the past few months. But previously, I would champion him for being a gamer. You can tell when he's on the stage that he at least, if he doesn't care about games, he does a good job convincing people that he cares about games, you know, in the same way that Sean Layden did. And you never got that from Jim Ryan, who would say things like that and also say things like, nobody wants to play old Gran Turismos. I do, Jim. I do. Put it on
I'd like an archive.
Plus, please.
Yeah. Give us a monthly PlayStation archive and we'll cough up the money for it. I'll find the money for that. question from Oversold Gaming. Now, this is a spoiler in regards to the original Final Fantasy VII. However, it is the big plot point that everybody, quote-unquote, already knows. And you already know, and it was on the front page of the Washington Times. That's how much of a big deal this thing is. However, if you don't want to know anything, I would say jump forward a few minutes. But question from Oversold Gaming, who says, with Final Fantasy VII Rebirth canonically taking place in a new timeline because I guess the party broke the shackles of fate at the end of Remake, do you think the infamous death scene from the OG game is going to be kept the same, changed or a little altered, but mostly the same, perhaps a cliffhanger? I want to see where you are on this, because me and you have never talked about this.
And we haven't really.
This death being Aerith, by the way.
Yes, of course. I've not played the original game, but I know the scene. I've seen the scene. I know its importance in gaming history. So I don't have much skin in the game. So I don't really mind what they do with it. I don't think it would be sacrilegious if they took it away. That said, I do want to see it still happen, but it probably will happen within a different context entirely, I think. They'll definitely just spit on it. It won't be scene for scene. Or if it is scene for scene, it'll have a different importance. Mm. I think, you know, we saw it with deaths that happened in the original game happening different or not at all to what happened in the remake. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that, you know, it's probably going to be a scene that sparks a million articles and a million think pieces and a million video essays. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking forward to that because there's so much anticipation around it. How is it going to happen? Is it going to happen that it's perhaps the game's biggest talking point?
Yeah. The idea of like remix and stuff. I'll not be specific at all. I've only played Rebirth for about 5 hours. But in those 5 hours, they've already done some really big, bold things that weren't in the marketing. There were shreds of the specific scenes I'm talking about in the marketing, but their full context wasn't there. And the way this game opens, me and Cy were both messaging each other last night, just going like, oh my God, what?
Right.
Like the first 5 minutes is very fun. And that's something that they've barely shown, if at all, really. And so there are things in here that are that allude to a level of confidence I hope they have throughout.
Yes.
Because where I am, 5 hours in, it's a bloated open world Ubisoft thing, and the open world stuff is like grinding me the hell down. But I'm there for all the story stuff, and it is one of the most iconic scenes in gaming history. It does get referred to as the sort of the Luke, I'm your father from Star Wars. Of gaming, and it is the thing that's propelling me through the story. Like, I don't care about the bloated open world stuff. I care about the characters. I care about what you're doing with this canon. And I'm curious what the hell they're doing.
A part of me, you know when we saw Zack at the end of Final Fantasy VII Remake and he was alive, and that was a huge surprise, even to someone like me who hasn't played Final Fantasy VII, but knows the story, knows how things are, quote-unquote, supposed to go.
You know bits and pieces,
I know bits and pieces about certain characters. That's about it, right?
I can't wait for you to know the full story. It's going to be awesome. No, unless they change it.
Well, that's it, right? But, like, when that Zack thing happened, and you kind of saw him, and it was like, oh, they are doing things different. Like, things are... This is not your daddy's Final Fantasy VII. I almost... I got such a pop from that, but I wonder how it would have landed if they saved that big everything's different reveal for Aerith not dying in game 2 and then suddenly for game 3 everything has changed. You know, I wonder if they dragged that out a little bit more until that moment, would it have been more impactful? Because now I have expectations that things are different, and that is also cool, but I think both are really interesting.
It's so we talked so much about AAA design, the amount of money in the industry, the idea of authorship and everything. This feels like, and it's so rare to have something be this big with this much money on it, that an entire company is hanging on this thing because of how much money Final Fantasy VII makes, and how Final Fantasy VII Remake bailed Square Enix out of the dip they were in after losing all the money on the Avengers, that it still feels curated and authored and authored as well. And I'm loving being along for the ride. I think I wax and wane on how much I actually think they're going to pull off the execution, because there are certain thematic cores to Final Fantasy VII, certain beats of that story that arguably need to come through, unless you want to tell a completely different story. But then why even do this if you're not going to get it back around to where the game ends up at the end of the OG? And so, like, I'm just curious. Like, every time some of these big things happen, like the end of Remake from 2020, where we're fighting time and fate and destiny itself to justify our own existence, which metatextually works as the Remake justifying itself. You have the whispers, all that kind of stuff. By the time we get to Rebirth, I'll not do specifics at all. That is not mentioned, at least where how far I am. That's not mentioned at all, that we fought in the sky and we fought destiny and we punched time in the face. Nothing at all. But I have to hope that it all will mean something by the end. And there is that creative through line coming through, and it is the original creatives. I keep going back to that, where I'm like, these are the original people, the original scenario writer, the original director and artist and everything. What are you guys trying to do with this? I'm terrified, to be honest. Because I love the original so much, and it doesn't take away from that. The original isn't going anywhere. They're not delisting it. But there's something about the originals coming back and then going again. And I keep going back to when they announced this in 2017 or 2016 at E3, and they said, you know, going forward, it was the voiceover, which I think is actually Red 13's voice actor.
Right.
But anyway... saying, you know, the unknown journey is going to happen. It may bring fear, it may bring joy, but let us embrace what it brings. And I'm like, okay, this is some weird, like, Tenet stuff with Nolan, where he's like, I can't fully explain it, but I want you to go along for the ride.
Yeah.
And I just hope that it's all worth it by the end.
As a lover of Final Fantasy VII, would you not prefer that this is its own thing that complements and is separate from Final Fantasy VII? Because if FF7 was just kind of remade with modern mechanics and a modern engine, and it was kind of beat for beat, like, that would, of course, be a project worthy of hype. But if you were going to spread it out over three games, for me personally, as like an outsider, the story probably would have been enough to get me through, but it wouldn't have been on the level of hype that it is now, knowing that things are changing and that an unknown element to it. It's you know, Resident Evil 4 did it to a lesser extent, but the way that plays with your knowledge of the original, I just think is a fascinating way to do a remake in a world where we have so many ports and remasters already. It's just, that is always, especially when the original creators are on board, like you said, or some of the original creators, that is, to me, it's fascinating to see that play out on a big scale, because it does make it this big talking point, and it makes it bigger, I think, than what a Final Fantasy VII straight remake would have been. Totally. That would have been huge, but this feels like on another level now.
Oh, totally. Like, the being terrified is genuine, being excited is genuine. Like, it's everything. I won't know till we get to the end of the third part, or at least what happens at the end of this one. I'll tell you what it reminds me of, though, which is a bygone MCU energy. It reminds me of when you had Kevin Feige being out there, you had the Russos getting out there, and and everything felt curated. You felt quite safe going along for that ride. I can't wait to see what they do next. Oh my God, this trailer, let's mine that trailer. And then they were wise to that and they shot things differently, or they put a special effect in the trailer that it alluded to something else. They removed a character from a scene to throw you off. The beginning of Rebirth is pure MCU payoff energy, where you're there at midnight and you're watching it going like, oh my God, that's what that scene was. Oh my God, that, like, that's really fun. And you can argue it's outdated. You can argue it's from a different decade, which it is. But there is a fun there. There's a fun audience ride thrill to that that I never expected Final Fantasy VII Remake to do at all. But they are doing it very well. They do have us talking, and they have managed to tick a box where it works for newcomers and veterans. It's just also terrifying because you're playing with, it's the equilibrium thing. You're treading on my dreams. You're like doing this thing where you're picking and prodding and pulling it apart. And the last time they did that was the 10th year anniversary with Advent Children, Dirge of Cerberus, and Crisis Core. And I like Advent Children a lot, but Dirge of Cerberus and Crisis Core are below the bar, I would say, considerably, especially with Dirge of Cerberus and a lot of Crisis Core. But still, that whole idea of, like, you went back to this beautiful little thing that you never intended to be this global dominating thing.
Yeah.
It's like, if you give it another 20 years, someone goes back to Powell World and they pick it all apart. Like, you've got to do it right.
You do. But I think the video game industry needs more of that terror.
It totally does. It totally does.
You know, going back to...
I'm not saying don't do it, sorry.
Oh, no, of course not. Of course not. I know, like I said, it's an exciting ride right? Like, I want more games to have that sense of excitement, that sense of unknown, that sense of terror, and that sense of consequence. I think that's really important to me when I'm talking about story games. Like, I want things to matter. I want things to feel big. What I'm going to mention The Last of Us Part 2, because I always mention The Last of Us Part 2 on every single podcast that I possibly can. But, you know, if love that game, hate that game, fall somewhere in the middle, we'll be talking about that game for the next 10, 20 years. You know, we'll be picking apart those plot points. Should they have done that? Should they have done this? Was that right? How does that impact the original? And I think that those games are worthy of having. It means that it's something that I can love. It's something that you can think didn't really need to exist. And I like that with Final Fantasy VII, that it is taking those big swings and is getting everyone talking, both fans and non-fans, about the consequences of the last game.
They've also as well, it's a Herculean feat what they've pulled off, not only from the budgeting and finance side of it and the reality of, you know, you had specific people like Tetsuya Nomura saying, if we don't do this now, we're going to die. Yeah. We're old people. We're getting older. Nobuo Uematsu, legendary composer, godfather of video game music, literally said he hasn't got more in him. He's too old. And he's like, it's too much of a mental, physical toll. I can't keep composing. I only have a few more things left. So that it is, you know, that such an exquisitely specific thing to get right. And they've also in there managed to remind people to play the original. It works better for you if you play the original and then play these remakes. Like, you're better served having that wider context because they're playing with all those expectations.
Yep, fully agree. You know, we live in an era where remasters and remakes are sometimes made to invalidate the original and replace the original. That's why I love stuff like Final Fantasy VII and Resident Evil 4, because you get even more out of those games if you are knowledgeable or you have experience with those original titles. You know when they're talking to each other. Like George Lucas would say, it's like, it rhymes, Scott Hill, but it's like poetry.
He always comes back as well.
He certainly does. They intersect with each other in an amazing way that allows both to exist and both to remain as iconic as ever.
Josh Brown, we have time for one more question, but we will be kicked out of the studio in about 7 minutes. So, last question from Ben Jammer, who says, how would you define an RPG in 2024?
Oh, not a big one then.
So many games have incorporated RPG-like mechanics over the years, such as XP, open worlds, and loot systems that the lines have blurred with action-adventure games. I would consider a true RPG to have organic elements for the player to discover.
Yeah, I think the RPG label got watered down in about 2008 or 2009 with the release of Borderlands. I remember people describing that as that was the first time I heard the word action RPG.
Right.
And that was so different from what I associated with RPGs at the time. And I think as we get into an almost postmodern era with games, genres are just appropriated so much across the board that everything is a little bit of everything else. Yes. You know, something has RPG elements, something has, story-based elements, live service elements, multiplayer elements. But now, to me, like, a true RPG is still something like a Baldur's Gate or a CD Projekt Red game or a Bethesda game. It's something that is, it doesn't necessarily have to be exclusively single-player, but it has that sense of authorship over the world from a player's perspective, alongside a wealth of interesting characters and deep mechanics and a chunky story to get involved with.
Yeah, I think it has to be fundamentally character-based. You have to be building your character with some sort of stat regimen. There are mechanics that are based around building your character up, unlocking abilities, and some sort of... Some sort of like thematic unison between the way you're building your character and the world itself, like some sort of like you're exploring for a reason, you're getting better over time, and you have that almost monomyth backbone of the story itself. It's a grand sweeping thing. It's not a small scale story. I can't think of that many small scale single location RPGs. It tends to nearly always be a bigger thing. I don't think it's a prerequisite necessarily, but it's historically it's always been a big thing. And I think I love JRPGs. I love the tenets that make up JRPGs, whether it be party systems, different stylistic elements, or whatever. And I love the rise of Western RPGs, the BioWares, the Bethesdas, you know, like they celebrate all of it. But I think there's something about going on a grand adventure that makes me think of the, I'm forgetting the dude's name who wrote about the monomyth.
Yeah.
Joseph someone. That idea of all these big sweeping stories fall into certain templates, and some of the best stories ever written, your Star Warses, your MCUs, tick those boxes. And I think there's a lot of like, monomyth DNA in RPG. And
that it's is like, really interesting.
It has to escalate to a degree.
Oh, that is interesting. I wouldn't, surprisingly, wouldn't necessarily agree with.
I think it has to. No. Well, maybe it does. I just can't think of it. I can't think of a small scale RPG. It, like, they sort of invokes a level of time, character building, time investment. Like,
I guess I would have to know specifically what you mean by scale, because I would describe something as like Disco Elysium is one of my favorite RPGs.
That's
ever.
A perfect one.
But would that match your scale criteria? Because to me, that's quite small scale in terms of it's character driven.
No,
one murder, it's set in one city, you know?
That's a weird one, because it definitely has, that's something where I would say that's almost like a text adventure. Like, that's like Escape from Monkey Island. Like, you're clicking on stuff, you're interacting.
Fascinating.
Like, it doesn't, it's not that it has RPG elements. You are unlocking stats, you're building like the thought processes, you're talking to a lot of characters, dialogue choices and everything. Yeah. And it is a single location. Multiple locations, but it's not that big. It's one city kind of thing. That's the best argument you could give me.
That's like almost. It's funny, man. Yeah, I love this question. to me, that's almost like the mecca of what an RPG is, because
it's a role.
If you're literally like looking at the words "role playing game," I can't think of anything in the last 20 years, with the exception of maybe Fallout New Vegas, that gives you as much control over your character and what you do in that world, as Disco Elysium. Like, your main character, who's called Harry, obviously has a name, he has a defined history, but you can tailor who that guy is, his ideological framework is, how he approaches the day, right down to like those granular details in his relationships with people, and such a astonishing level that I would, for me, that's like a core RPG that
It definitely is in that regard. I mean, the thing is, like, I don't even want to put boundaries up. I think that it's interesting looking at the history of these labels and when they got applied to certain things. And I have an affinity for what would be classed as the JRPG, whether it's the Final Fantasy, you know, Dragon Quest, Tales, whatever. Disco works for the most part. It's just that for me, the DNA of that is closer to a text adventure, like in terms of, because that you like you have all the thought processes that you're unlocking as Harry, which is the distinguishing stat element that would bring it more in line with an RPG if I'm Venn diagramming. But if I, to me, like you're playing that character in as much as you're playing like Guybrush Threepwood. Like it's not customized.
I would definitely disagree with that.
But spending time with them, exploring one location, like, I don't know. For me, Disco is more of like a text adventure.
I think, like, if I go back to the history of RPGs, I'd personally say that's more of a, and I don't want to even necessarily use this term, but a true RPG than something like a Bethesda game. Just because if I personally would trace the RPG's history, end up going back to the original Fallouts, which I do think have way more in common with Disco Starfield, for instance.
Well, I mean, the genre itself is going to go back to, like, all those original 90s, late 80s games that were inspired by D&D.
Yeah.
And, like, that whole idea of, like but still, that's, like, specking a character, specking a party, specking, like, attack. I started thinking about combat when you were describing Disco, and I was like, that idea of, like, RPG combat is a thing, whether it's turn-based or live-action, and Disco doesn't really have any combat. Like, it does have dice rolls and stuff, though. So, like, whatever.
Interesting. But, I think, you know, the only...
We have 2 minutes, Josh Brown.
I'll go quick. The only limitations I'd put on what isn't an RPG is if you are saying something is an RPG just because you have skill trees and stats. Like, I hate when like a first-person shooter is described as an RPG because it just lets you, like, upgrade your guns or something, you know? I think that sort of stat-based element sometimes takes too much focus. It obviously is important, but I think you actually hit the nail on the head where I come down to it. It's character focus.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be a custom character. It can be an entirely authored character from the developers, but it is a game that is character focused, where you're playing a role, whether that's yours or someone else's, and you're living in a world, and that's the primary focus. You can have other things that are important, combat, exploration, but the characters are the primary focus.
And that's
how I would define it.
Yeah, totally. And the Guybrush comparison was literally, I meant like mechanically, you're walking around, you're talking to people, you're like living in as that one character for that long kind of thing, and the way you move around that world. But no, I would back that. Like, it's like that thing over time where it feels like your character is your own. Which is why a lot of people didn't like Final Fantasy 16, because they couldn't customize Clive that much, or the party or whatever. I guess like Western RPGs tend to focus a bit more on individual character fleshing out as opposed to a JRPG party, where it's like you're not necessarily specking Cloud more than anyone else kind of thing.
That is true, but I think, I fully agree with you, but even in like those cases, it's like, you know, Clive had such strong characterization alongside the rest of the cast, so that focus on character I do think bridges both JRPGs and Western RPGs, though if we got into what is a JRPG specifically, I'm sure we'd go on for another hour and a half, so we best wrap it here.
One of my favorite conversations, but it'll be saved for another time. Thank you to everybody for sending in their various questions, etc. This has been the UBP. I've been Scott Tilford. That's been Josh Brown.
Always a pleasure, Scott Tilford.
Always a pleasure to get through another week with you and everyone else listening at home. Take care, have a lovely weekend, and we'll catch you soon.
Bye.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.